Hello, it's Thursday, December 15th, and you're listening to Wing Radio. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing Radio. Today we're going to jump right into things. We have one of our favorite people in the whole world,
Someone
we consider the best political writer in the country, Mr. Michael Collins Piper. He's the author of Final Judgment, The High Priests of War, The New Jerusalem, and the recently released The Michael Collins Piper Reader. He's also a reporter for the American Free Press and also a longtime writer for the Spotlight before that. So we'd like to welcome Mr. Michael Collins Piper to Wing TV. How you doing, Michael?
Oh, I'm glad to be on the show. I'm sorry I didn't make it on sooner. I think your listeners should know that I missed you 2 weeks in a row, and you had to scramble to fill up that time, and I'm sorry about that.
Oh, that's no problem. Now, before we start asking you some questions, I want to tell everyone about this book, The Michael Collins Piper Reader. And anytime that we publish a book here, you go over the book time after time after time, editing it, proofing it, just making sure everything is perfect with it. And by the time you read it the fourth or fifth time, you start going crazy and you just say, I can't read another word. But with this book, it was just the opposite. Every single time I read it, I wanted to read it even more because every single time you can see more of the interconnections and how all of these writings through the year
tie together. It's so multi-dimensional.
So it was just a pleasure to do something that's really not very much fun, which is proofreading and editing a book. So you have something very special here, Michael.
Well, you know, I have to say thank you to you and Lisa, because it was a real honor to me that you put that book together. You know, it's kind of hard for me. And I've estimated that I've written about 4,000 different articles.
Wow.
Over the years. It could be a little more, it could be a little less, but I'd say roughly about 4,000 different pieces. Most of them under my name, most of them, and a lot of them, actually, I've put other people's names on some articles I've written. So my output's been, or I should say other people have had articles published that were really written by me. So, so you know, what I'm saying is I have written a lot over the years, and it's kind of hard to pick and choose the best or the most significant. So when you try to get something like that together, you do kind of find yourself trying to get it in a theme.
Right.
You know, and you know, basically, you know, I have focused a lot on specifically the power of political Zionism in official Washington and around the world. And
yep.
People say, oh, you're constantly harping about the power of the Jews and complaining about Zionist power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the thing about it is, the way I look at it, it's a reality. It's a political reality, and it may be the most significant political reality that there is today. So,
and
if you can't talk about it, then we don't have freedom of speech.
Right.
And especially when you read this collection of your essays, you realize actually how dramatic it is and the power that these people that you mentioned have. Now, what we're going to do today, Mike, was kind of have a two-pronged interview. I'm going to ask you about some current events going on, while Lisa's going to ask you questions about from your book, the Michael Collins Piper Reader. So the first thing, I'm sure you're aware of this, is the Iranian president has been coming out for the last few weeks and making some very inflammatory statements, questioning the Holocaust, saying that this nation of Israel should be moved to Europe or the United States, saying that Israel should be wiped off the face of the map. Then you have Benjamin Netanyahu saying if he was elected president, he would have a preemptive strike against Iran, and on and on. And it almost gets to the point where it's so outrageous, it almost seems like it's parody, like you have actors just trying to brew the pot to get a war going. What are your thoughts?
You know, I'm sorry you said that, Victor, because that's precisely the thought that was going through my head today. It is almost like a parody. It is almost like a stage show. And this makes me wonder whether or not that is exactly what is going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have been accused of being a conspiracy theorist, but, you know, I have to realize and I have to recognize that, in fact, there are powers that work behind the scenes. And sometimes these stage shows that we see performed in front of us between ostensible enemies, you know, the evil Iranian versus the good Israeli, you know, and mm-hmm. so forth. You know, these characters. You know, it may well be that the president of Iran is actually is deliberately trying to stoke up a war. Yeah. I mean, it may be that he is he has an agenda that we may not be aware of. So, I mean, it's very, very clear that his statements are highly controversial. You know, and yet on the other hand, if you actually look at what he said in some of these instances, it's not really as outrageous.
Oh, I don't think so either.
As it's been presented. I mean, you know, they say he denies the Holocaust. Well, you know what I do know that he did say was that the Holocaust has been made into being an issue of paramount importance, that it's more important than religion, it's more important than nationality, it's more important than God.
Matt, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up.
I'm sorry to say he is absolutely right, because it's like the thing that is the most sacrosanct thing in the world today. I mean, it's absolutely amazing how people will just drop to their knees at the mention of the word Holocaust, as though it's something so profound. There's nothing, you know. I find it amusing that we're constantly told that violence on television and violence in the films contributes to violence in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
That children shouldn't be allowed to watch violent television because it desensitizes them to violence, and yet, on a daily basis, school children all across this country are being inculcated in Holocaust studies.
Right.
Being shown the most violent images of human destruction. Is this not contributing to the ruination of their psyche? I don't know, but I mean, you know, it's the Holocaust has really become quite a profitable industry, as Dr. Norman Finkelstein called it.
I'm glad you brought that up, Michael.
The Holocaust industry. And, you know, there's a lot of people who make a lot of profit off the Holocaust. And, you know, I'll tell you, I have gotten to the point myself, frankly, I'm tired of hearing about the Holocaust. You know, because as I always like to point out, I happen to be of American Indian descent. And when I think of what's happened to the American Indians, that pretty much constitutes a Holocaust. And, you know, the Israelis say that because of the Holocaust, they should have their ancestral home in the Middle East, and they can come in there and take the land away from Palestinians, some of whose families have lived there for hundreds of years. Well, on that same argument, the American Indians could start reclaiming some of their fancy property on Manhattan Island, and
exactly.
I can say there's a lot of rich New York Jews who love Israel.
Michael,
I'd be very upset if the American Indians started coming back and claiming Manhattan Island.
I'm glad you brought up the Holocaust, Michael. In the Michael Collins Piper Reader, you wrote a piece called An American of American Indian Heritage Speaks Out, The Holocaust is Over, Enough is Enough. How has the Holocaust become an industry, a political tool, where money is extorted from other nations to Israel to manipulate and influence foreign policy in favor of Israel?
Well, that's exactly what it is, Don. I mean, you know, as I say, everyone shudders in fear at the word Holocaust because it's such a potent political tool. You know, if you criticize Israel, you're reminded about the Holocaust. You know, if a politician makes a remark that's slightly critical of Israel, you know, they'll raise the issue of anti-Semitism and say, oh, look, it's so, ain't it awful, Mabel? 6 million Jews were killed. We have to support Israel. And of course, you know, on top of that, they say, you know, that the United States has a moral commitment to Israel, to Israel's survival. Well, that moral commitment to Israel's survival costs the American people tens of billion dollars,
You're
tens
right.
of billions of dollars every year. And, you know, we can also argue, as people will argue and have argued, that the whole Iraq war was fought for the security and safety of Israel, and that's costing us how many billion dollars a month? I don't even know.
Exactly. That's a great point.
So, you know, the Holocaust indeed is used as a political tool to prop up Israel. I mean, I literally have had conversations. I've had conversations with people in which I have said something critical of the state of Israel about something happening in Israel today, the treatment of the Palestinians. And this has happened to me more than once. People have not responded directly to what I have said, citing Israel's specific outrages.
Mm-hmm.
But they have come back to me. This has happened to me twice that I can think of. People have come back at me and said, Well, you know, there was a Holocaust.
Like,
you know, in other words, there was a Holocaust 50 years ago, so therefore Israel can do anything it wants.
Yeah, that justifies. Well, since you're bringing that up, recently there was a United Nations universal ban on revisionism, and also there's been the arrest, deportation, and or detainment of people like David Irving, Ernst Zundel, Guillermo Rudolph, Mordecai Vanunu, and one person was even arrested because he questioned the Anne Frank story. So with this in mind, Michael, does it make people who write about Zionist issues or the Holocaust the most dangerous writers in the world?
Well, sadly, I think that is indeed the case, because, you know, I could write articles advocating child abuse, and I would be held as an intellectual thinker.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? I could write articles advocating bestiality, and I would be called, a creative genius. But I write anything critical of Israel, and I'm considered, really one of the worst possible people on the face of the planet. These people that you have named, it's very, very sad to mention that, while these are some pretty prominent names,
mm-hmm.
there are almost, as I understand it, between 10 and 15,000 people jailed in Germany today because they have raised points about the Holocaust. Not that they've denied the Holocaust.
That's incredible.
But that they have, questioned whether or not there were actually gas chambers at this concentration camp or that concentration camp, or said that maybe 600,000 Jews died during World War II rather than 6 million. Things like this. It's not like people are out there, quote-unquote, denying the Holocaust or denying that there were concentration camps. You know, these people have quibbled about, and not all of the above mentioned, obviously Mordecai Vanunu is not considered a Holocaust denier, but the ones you mentioned, these people have quibbled with some of the details of history. And for that, they are in jail. And like I say, there's tens of thousands of people now in jail. But I mean, here in the United States, what our real concern is that we obviously don't have laws outlawing Holocaust denial, quote unquote. But we are increasingly seeing a push for more and more laws and more measures to, I guess it's kind of being put into the mainstream.
The
theory that, if you take a political position, it could potentially lead to violence, and therefore you have to control public dissent. You know, we have the Patriot Act, which is expanding governmental control over our liberties here in this country. I mean, these are all part and parcel of the Zionist problem, and it is we do have a problem with Zionism because all of these efforts to silence freedom of speech in the name of fighting, quote unquote, fighting hate and and preserving Israel and commemorating the 6 million who died during World War II and all of this fancy rhetoric that we hear about, all this is used to justify police state powers in this country, and it all stems from one source, I'm sorry to say.
That's right.
Right. In a piece that you wrote entitled Israel and Islamic Fundamentalism, Michael, you point out that Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad, has had a little-known role in providing financial and tactical support for the very people they claim to be their sworn enemies, the Muslim extremists. Can you explain to everybody why Israel would do such a thing?
This is something that a lot of people don't understand. But if they come to recognize how covert operations are carried out, maybe they can better understand it. And that is that Israel, over the years, when they were fighting the Palestinian movement under Yasser Arafat, they had a real problem with Arafat because Arafat, although he was a Muslim, he was very pragmatic. He was very secular. He had many Christians among his top advisors because there is a substantial number of Christians in the Palestinian Arab community. So, what the Israelis wanted to do was undermine Yasser Arafat's secular authority by expanding the influence of the Muslims, who tended to be a little bit more radical. or I should say a particular group of Muslims who happen to be a little bit more radical. So to undermine Yasser Arafat, they started financing the Hamas movement. Well, Hamas took off on all of its own, and I'm pretty sure to this day is quite independent of Israel. But nonetheless, the fact is, it was Israel that got Hamas going in the first place. So if Hamas is indeed the terrible terrorist threat that the Israelis claim it to be, we have only the Israelis to thank for having gotten it off the ground in the first place.
Very, very ironic.
I did mention one other thing. One of the most famous terrorists in the world, one of the most famous Palestinian terrorists in the world, Abu Nidal, is widely believed to have actually been financed by the Israelis because he had a habit of gunning down people that the... he had a habit of gunning down people that that were actually trying to make real serious peace overtures at a time when Israel didn't want peace. So the thing is, it's what we see is not always what we get, and I guess I suppose that's probably an underlying theme of a lot of my own writing. I try to show the other side of the story. I try to show the angles that other people either deliberately ignore or just somehow miss. So again, that's all. And I think if you looked at 3,000 of the 4,000 stories I've written over the years, that would probably be the common theme among them.
Yeah. Now there's a new Steven Spielberg movie coming out called Munich, and this is based upon the 1972 Olympics, which took place over in Munich, and it's based upon a book by Aaron Klein called Striking Back, the 1972 Munich Olympics Massacre and Israel's Deadly Response. And what they get into is how after these killings took place at the 72 Olympics, there was something that the media called the Wrath of God team, which was essentially a Mossad assassination team that went out to try to find the killers at the 72 Olympics. But what they point out is that many of the people that were killed weren't actually the ones who were responsible for the killings at the 72 Olympics. So what do you know about that?
I wasn't aware of that till just the other day, the fact that a lot of those people who were killed had nothing to do with that. But, it's interesting. There's a couple interesting angles here about this. Number one, that story, the story of how the Mossad went out and killed the enemies. First of all, let's start on this basis. I don't think there's anybody in the world who didn't feel bad when these young Israeli athletes were killed. I mean, that's not a nice thing to do. I mean, these people, these are innocent sports people, here at the Olympics. The Olympics is supposed to be one of these kind of things that, unite everybody. And here's these poor young kids being killed. And so, that story was tailor-made for Israeli propaganda purposes because, the story has been out for years of how the Israelis, took vengeance upon these evil Arab terrorists who killed these young Israelis. And, most people say, well, good for them. The funny thing is, though, that, like you say, they point out that, well, actually, the story, what we've heard, is not really true. But what's even more interesting is, from today's perspective, apparently, the former head of the Mossad is very upset with Steven Spielberg for making that movie.
Uh-huh, I've read that.
And Leon Wieseltier, who is this prominent Jewish intellectual who often writes for the New Republic, he has taken off after Steven Spielberg, too. So it's kind of funny. It's like when it comes to this issue of Israel and the Jews, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. And this is what even Spielberg himself, who is... who's obviously Jewish and a major contributor to Jewish causes, here he makes a movie that even the Israelis don't like. So it's kind of going to be. I'm looking forward to seeing the movie. Apparently, Spielberg's critics think he's too friendly to the terrorists. As I say, you're damned if you do, damned
That's
if you
right.
don't.
It's become ever clearer over the decades that Israel has figured prominently in some of the nastiest business that's occurred, like the assassination of JFK, their major involvement in the attack of the USS Liberty, which was a war crime. Why is it so difficult for people to believe that Israel might have had a prominent role in 9/11?
Well, you know, I tell you, it's kind of interesting. There's a lot of schizophrenia even in the so-called patriot movement here in America, because I constantly see people who believe that Israel was involved in 9/11, saying that they're afraid there's going to be another 9/11 attack from domestic Muslim terrorists. So, you know, they want to have their cake and eat it, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as Israel being involved, or, you know, people, the way the media has presented 9/11 from the very beginning, it's only natural that people would have difficulty believing that the Israelis played a part in orchestrating 9/11. Americans are just so hypnotized.
I'm talking about 9/11.
Media. It's an avalanche, you know, of propaganda. So it's just a sad reality that people just, you know, are so accustomed to being beamed with false messages and false images from the mass media that, you know, generally Israel gets only good coverage. So, you know, although, you know, it's funny, you know, if suddenly, well, this is never going to happen, but let's put it this way. If suddenly the mass media in America started saying nasty things about Israel, the American people would do a flip-flop.
Yeah.
Because they are so led around by the nose by the media that they believe anything and take the lead from the media. So, but like I said, I don't think we need to worry about that happening.
Yeah. Now, Michael, we were talking a couple weeks ago, and the subject of the war in Iraq came up, and you mentioned something that it was a very unique angle on John Murtha, who's the head of the Defense Appropriations Committee, and your take is that he's really representing the Army, you're speaking for them and saying that we're getting tired of this war. Explain a little bit more about really what a significant role Murtha is taking now.
Yeah, this is something, again, that I don't think a lot of Americans understand, because, you know, coming back to the way, as I say, Americans being so led by the media, Americans tend to look at the world in a black and white perspective. You know, everything's, you know, there's either, you have your, it's like the cartoon villains, you know, the spy versus spy in Mad Magazine.
Uh-huh.
One is in white and one is in black. You know, there's heroes and there's villains. And what it has come down to is the American people see the president surrounded by smiling troops. That's, he stages these appearances at military bases. And all these, you know, clean-cut young men and women with nice smiles. I mean, you'd swear that there's no ugly members of the military. You know, they put all these good-looking kids surrounding the president who cheer him on.
It's like there's a carnival.
And the American people say, oh, that's great. The military supports the president. And then, on the evening news, when you get reports from Iraq, from the military, you see a handful of military men coming up and stating the administration's position. The military people have to answer to the commander-in-chief. However, the fact is that there are a lot of people in the military who obviously cannot speak out, but those people are relying on John Murtha to do it for them.
Yeah.
Right. Michael, you've pointed out that in the 50s and 60s, CBS News was nicknamed CIA Broadcasting System. And in 1977, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Carl Bernstein wrote about how 400 CIA-funded journalists had infiltrated the American media under Operation Mockingbird and had been carrying out CIA assignments for the previous 25 years. How would you assess the state of the media today as far as CIA infiltration?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, actually, I think, now, I don't know this for a fact, but I think it would be safe to say that there are probably a handful of newspapers in this country that are almost owned outright by the CIA.
Uh-huh.
CIA has generated so much money through its black operations over the years, its involvement in the drug trade, and in concert with Israel's Mossad, that they certainly have enough money to do it. But then when you consider the fact the Washington Post, the flagship newspaper probably of the country, even more so than the New York Times, if you consider the fact that the Washington Post has had a long and cozy relationship with the CIA, essentially a house organ of the CIA in many respects. You actually have the news being dictated by the CIA because there's a lot of newspapers around the country that rely on the Washington Post for their leads in reporting what will be the news in their own hometowns. You know,
what about television?
Newspapers around the country.
What about television?
Well, that's an interesting point, too. And I've never looked into the real history of the broadcast networks, but my understanding from what I have read over the years is that, in fact, during World War II in particular, the radio broadcasting networks, which eventually, you know, evolved into television broadcasting networks and television and radio, there was a lot of interplay between the intelligence agencies in Washington and these networks, and during wartime. And, of course, that relationship continued in post-war years, and, of course, then we had the development of the CIA as an entity in 1948. So there is an interconnection there that's been long-standing. You know, it's really, in some respects, a very incestuous relationship.
Yeah. Now, I was coming home from work last week, and I was listening to Bill O'Reilly's radio show on the radio, and he was talking about this story about how America is having journalists plant stories, not only in this country, but also in foreign papers, including Iraq. And Bill O'Reilly was saying, this is exactly what America should be doing. The more propaganda we spread in this forum, the better it is. And anybody that disagrees with this is basically an extremist against this country. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, Bill O'Reilly is kind of a windbag. And, you know, I often think a lot of the positions he takes, he has almost become a parody of himself.
Exactly.
You know, talk about a parody. That Bill O'Reilly, that should be his middle name. I hate to say that about a fellow Irishman, but
Bill O'Parody.
I'm not too pleased with him. But I would have to say this, though. It's kind of funny that there is, I find it amusing, pathetically amusing, that there is this controversy about stories being planted, because this is what most mainstream journalism is in America anyway, planted stories. So I don't know why anyone should, you know, in a way it's almost laughable that anyone's really concerned about something that the U.S. government does daily.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you look at what counts as news in most newspapers, whether they're local newspapers or whether they're national newspapers, you'll find that they're basically reprints of press releases from the government with very little opposition to it. You know what I mean? So granted, there are a few courageous independent local newspapers. But, you know, you look at your local newspapers right there in central Pennsylvania where you're located, that's all you're going to find.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so it's, like I say, maybe we shouldn't be too hard on the Bush administration in this thing, because this has been a crime against the truth that's been going on since the day one, I suppose.
Yeah.
Standard operating procedure.
Yeah, standard operating procedure.
In the book.
Though it may be, yeah.
In the book, Michael, you relate a great anecdote about your dad. Recently we had the anniversary of Pearl Harbor pass, and your dad was a big fan of Roosevelt, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. My father, he just thought Roosevelt was the best thing since sliced bread.
Did he ever change his mind before? Did he ever change his mind?
No, it was interesting. It was very, very interesting because, you know, as I say, my father fought in the Pacific during World War II. He was your proverbial proud Marine. And, you know, he went to war. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I can tell the truth here because it is the truth. The reason why he enlisted was not out of some great patriotic duty. He didn't even have to enlist because he was a railroad engineer, and that was considered, in other words, railroad engineers didn't have to go into the war because they were considered vital to the war effort. He wanted to get away from his first wife, so he enlisted in the Marines. This is the truth. You know, a lot of people today will tell these grand patriotic stories about how their father marched off the war, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's why my father marched off the war. He wanted to get away from his first wife. And here he went over to the Pacific. He got wounded. made it home. But he accepted the standard histories of why we went to war. But over the years, I started giving him a lot of material that he had never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Books and information which raised questions about what FDR's real policies really were. And by the end, my father had done a complete turnabout, and while he could never quite bring himself to condemn Franklin Roosevelt, he did, in fact, come full circle and come to realize that, in his opinion, as it is my opinion, World War II was a war that really need not and should not have been fought.
Yeah, that's a great
point. And that's a controversial position to take, but I stand behind that 100%, and I'm pleased to say that I played a part in providing my father, a veteran, a proud veteran of World War II, the information that he needed to come to that conclusion himself. And, you know, the amazing thing is, I find more and more, you know, although we get the public image, you know, on Veterans Day, and particularly now during this so-called war against terrorism, we're presented this idea that that all veterans of World War II, you know, were, you know, slap-happy, anti-Nazi fanatics, you know, who wanted to really go over and get Hitler. Actually, there's quite a few veterans of World War II who realize now that, just as my father came to realize, that World War II, again, was not precisely what it's been painted to be.
You're right.
Absolutely.
Now, one last question, Michael. A week or two ago, there were rumors, and I don't think these are going to pan out, but nonetheless, that Donald Rumsfeld was going to be replaced as the head of the DOD by Joe Lieberman. Now, Joe Lieberman, of course, is a liberal Democrat, but he has very war hawkish views. So my question to you is that it seems as if Zionism, or the support for the Zionist cause, this war in Iraq, is actually taking precedence once again over partisan politics, where a Democrat could actually join a Republican administration to lead the war. What are your
thoughts? I'll tell you what. You know, I won't embarrass myself by telling you the following story, because it shows that even a great prophet like I am can sometimes be wrong. But I was actually telling people back prior to the 2004 presidential election that I thought it was a very good possibility that Joe Lieberman would actually be George Bush's reelection running mate.
Uh-huh.
Now, my basis, my foundation for that was certain things that I was seeing in the press at the time. And as I was telling people, my prediction was predicated on the possibility that Howard Dean might have gotten the Democratic presidential nomination. And if indeed he had gotten the Democratic presidential nomination, I think that could have been enough to stimulate Lieberman to jump ship and go into the Republican Party. I think, you know, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Lieberman would join. I'll make a prediction. If Lieberman joins the Bush administration in the cabinet facing Rumsfeld, which is a possibility, there was some speculation, I believe that will set him up to become a Republican Party candidate on the national ticket.
Say it ain't so.
Well, Reverend Jerry Falwell said that he thought Joe Lieberman was splendid.
Uh-huh.
Now, coming from Jerry Falwell, who is a leader of the Christian right, which has a very strong influence within the Republican Party today, I don't think there'd be any problem with Joe Lieberman stepping into the Republican Party.
Yikes.
Yeah.
I can see it very easily.
Oh, I
can
too.
Lieberman. Heard it here first, folks.
Yeah, and that's reinforced because when you listen to the conservative talk show hosts, they hate all the Democrats except Joe Lieberman.
That's right.
And he's the one that they always herald as you know, the savior of the Democratic Party. But
absolutely. Yeah. I really believe we are being set up for Lieberman in 2008 on the Republican ticket, probably for vice president.
Yeah.
We need an act of God.
Yeah. Hey, Michael, before we close out today, I just want to commend not only you, but also the American Free Press, too, because there's a lot of quote-unquote sources in the alternative media that seem to only use 9/11 when it's convenient. Well, since day one, the American Free Press, and yourself included, have been trumpeting the exposure of the truth about 9/11. And
well, we thank you so much for that.
And 4 years later, they're still...
That's right.
Right on this, you know, basically every week, and they just published debunking 9/11, which you have quite a number of articles in, and they just do a hell of a job down there covering 9/11.
Yeah, you know, the thing about it is, I'm not sure wherever, it's kind of like the Kennedy assassination, you know, we're never going to know all the forensic details. We're never going to be able to prove it all, because obviously they've destroyed the evidence.
Right.
But I guess the bottom line, as I say, is this, that we know one thing about 9/11, and that is this, that the government's version of what happened is a 100% absolute lie.
You're right.
Amen to that.
Yep, you're right. Well, Michael, I just want to thank you for coming on, and I have to tell you, every single time we have you on...
We have so much fun.
Well, we have so much fun.
I do, too.
But your interviews last longer than any other person we ever interviewed.
And we don't care.
Because, I mean, we could sit here literally until 10 o'clock tonight and just chat with you. But once again, Michael Collins Piper, the author of Final Judgment, The High Priests of War,
The New Jerusalem,
and last but not least, the Michael Collins Piper Reader, which we were just honored to be able to publish. So, Michael, thanks once again for coming on. And
have
just,
a great holiday and feel better.
I will. Thanks to you. It's working.
Okay. Take care. We'll talk to you
take
soon.
Care.
And tomorrow we'll be back on Wing TV. We're going to have Mr. Tex Mars, who's going to talk about his latest book. So until then, think about the things Michael has to say and keep your eyes open, because there is a lot going on.
See you then, everyone.